Conceived soon after the American Revolution ended, the great monument to George Washington was not finally completed until almost a century later. The obelisk was finished in 1884 and remains the tallest stone structure in the world at 555 feet. In the new book, Washington's Monument and the Fascinating History of the Obelisk, acclaimed historian John Steele Gordon tells the largely untold story behind its construction, connecting it to the colorful saga of the ancient obelisks of Egypt. John Steele Gordon is one of America's leading historians, especially in the realm of business and financial history. The book is Washington's Monument, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Great pleasure.
I'm delighted to be here.
So what brought you to the subject and to even broaden it out further to the obelisk in general?
Well, it sort of started the other way around, in that I've always been interested in obelisks, mainly because they were so obviously extraordinarily expensive and so totally and completely useless. Why did the Egyptians go to such enormous trouble to create them? Why did the Romans steal them? Why did then the English and the French and the Americans help themselves to one each? And why did we build the world's largest obelisk in Washington, D.C.? And then it was simply decided that it would be a better idea to concentrate on the Washington Monument, about which we knew the most anyway, and use the other obelisks as a sort of relief.
At what point was the discussion open for a monument to Washington, and when the talk started to become a monument as an obelisk and something that would be where it is today?
Well, the Congress, the original Continental Congress, passed a bill in 1783, before the Treaty of Peace had actually been signed with Great Britain, calling for a huge equestrian statue of Washington on a monumental base with all his words and other founding fathers and what have you. That base never got made, but the statue itself was finally done in the 1850s, and is, you can find it in Washington, D.C. today. But it wasn't until 1831 or so that the movement to get a monument to Washington really began, and it was done by a private organization. They founded the Washington Monument Society, and they made Chief Justice John Marshall the president. He'd written a five-volume Life of Washington, and was a huge admirer of that president. And he said, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be president, but of course I can't, at my age, I can't really do much. In fact, he died a few months later. And it took them, after they founded the organization, it took them 17 years to finally raise enough money to at least start to build the monument. They got a man named Robert Mills, who was one of the first American-born formally trained architects. He is famous today for having designed the Treasury Building in Washington, and also the old Patent Office Building, which is now where the Museum of American Art is.
Right.
And he designed this obelisk, which would have had a mostly flat top, surrounded by an enormous classical pantheon with a statue of Washington in a chariot and 30 other founding fathers around him. And that was where he thought that Washington himself would be buried. Well, they finally, in 1848, they thought they had enough money to at least start building the obelisk, which had to be built first. And then they kept running out of money because they tried over and over again to find ways to get people to contribute, and people just didn't contribute very much. I think it wasn't because they didn't honor Washington. I think it was because they sort of felt that the nation should pay for this. And finally, in the 1850s, a political party known as the Know-Nothings, who were virulently anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic,
right,
actually seized control of the monument.
The hope in doing that would be what?
Well, they wanted to, I think it was mostly to make a political point. What they had already done was, the Washington Monument Society had asked states and foreign countries and organizations to send in stones to be placed in the walls on the inside of the Washington Monument, where the staircase is. And the Vatican City actually sent a stone from Pope Pius IX, and the Know-Nothings were outraged. They broke into where it was being built, stole the stone, apparently broke it up and threw it into the Potomac. At least it's never been found. And then they just took over the monument, and there wasn't much anything the Washington Monument Society could do. And then when the Civil War broke out, of course, everything stopped.
And then you write that with the end of the Civil War, the stump of the Washington Monument became more and more of an embarrassment to the city and the nation. So what finally got them into gear?
Well, in 1876, on the centennial celebration of American independence, Congress finally decided that it was just too embarrassing to have this stump standing there in the middle of what would become the Washington Mall. At that time, it was still pretty wild and woolly. And so Congress voted to finally put up the money. And the first thing they did was got an engineer from the Army Corps of Engineers to inspect the foundation. And he said it's not strong enough to take the 90,000 tons that the Washington Monument would eventually weigh. And so the first thing they had to do was strengthen the foundation, which was quite tricky. They had to dig it out to some extent. And they used miners who were used to this sort of work, and also apparently weren't scared of having, 20 or 30,000 tons of rock coming down on their head. And once the foundation was done, then they began building it, and it started in 1880, and by 1884, they had reached the top.
Was the idea of going 555 feet always part of the plan in the sense they wanted something that tall?
Well, they certainly wanted something monumental, and it was 55 feet on a side at the base. And the American ambassador to the Kingdom of Italy, whose name was George Perkins Marsh, went around Rome, where there are 11 erect Egyptian obelisks, and measured them very carefully, and he said that the proportions are always 10 to 1. And the pyramidion on the top, the pyramid, it should be 73 degrees from the horizontal. And so anyway, they were stuck with a base of 55 feet wide, and so therefore it had to be 550 feet tall in order to be 10 to 1.
So when it comes to looking at the roots of the obelisk in Egypt, what can we learn from that story, from looking at parts and certainly more of the story of the Washington Monument that you've been sharing with us?
Well, one thing we certainly know is that the Egyptians had abilities that we cannot really understand how they did it. I mean, how do you move a stone that weighs 400 tons? How do you chip it out of a quarry? And remember, these are all made of granite, a very hard stone. Get it out of that quarry, get it down to the Nile, get it onto a boat, move it to where it's eventually going to be erected, drag it up to the spot, and somehow get it upright. Remember, the Egyptians didn't even have iron tools. They didn't have pulleys. They didn't. All what they really had was infinite manpower. And that's how they did it. And to some ways, we know how they did it. I mean, there are a few drawings on tomb walls that show us obelisks on ships being moved and pictures of enormous statues being moved. They don't have one of an obelisk particularly being moved. But we know there's one papyri that shows us that a colossus, a huge statue of one of the pharaohs, to move it required 8,000 people. And 800 of them died in the process. I mean, so it was an enormous undertaking, and it's really just astonishing that they could do such a thing.
Once the monument was completed and then opened, then you write in the book that there were several stunts. Like there, even though it was done, there still have been modifications over the decades to basically bring it up to speed with what was happening so that planes weren't flying into it, people weren't jumping out the window, and there was even some reverence to the other states and adding the flags around the monument.
Indeed. Well, of course, the first thing they had to do was modify the lightning protection system because they thought they had it had been designed, the very peak of the Washington Monument is a a pyramidion made of aluminum, solid aluminum. It's about 9 inches high and about 6 inches across. And in 1884, aluminum was a precious metal. It was exceedingly expensive, and it's also a very good conductor of electricity. So they thought that would be a really classy way to, you know, get to the top of the Washington Monument. Well, within a few months, lightning zapped it, broke a few stones, and clearly it wasn't adequate. So they had to change the lightning protection. They've changed it several times since. The ones that are in place now were put in 2012 after the earthquake caused another restoration to be necessary. And the windows used to be open. And that's why people started jumping out of them, because, you know, some people who commit suicide want everybody to know about it.
You mentioned the earthquake that occurred. What is the current status of the Washington Monument as far as its stability?
It's completely stable. The earthquake did not threaten to bring it down. Even though stone structures are very intolerant of earthquakes. I mean, wooden structures and steel structures can flex to some extent and absorb the pressure wave moving through the earth. Stone just cracks, and it did in 2011. And there were places where you could actually see daylight from the inside looking through the granite. The outside is faced with marble. And so they had to spend, I think it was $16 million, getting everything put back together, but it's now completely stable and short of an event we cannot really imagine. It's safe for the ages, but it'll have to be like any other structure. It'll have to be maintained and repaired now and then.
What I also found fascinating is this monument has a pardon the pun, but a rocky history and going back and forth. Which seems to be the way of many monuments in Washington, that these things do grind on for a very long time. Is that a good process, or meaning that we work it out and we finally get the right thing, or is it overly complicated and more complicated than it really should be?
Well, often politics plays a part, and also taste often plays a part. I mean, for instance, the proposed monument for President Eisenhower has been in dispute for now for about 20 years,
right?
Because the artist, who's, I'm sorry, I cannot remember his name, who designed it, and the Eisenhower family absolutely hates it. And so what do we do? We haven't quite figured that out yet. Other times it just takes a long time. I mean, Daniel Chester French's magnificent seated statue of Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial just took a long time to make. That size statue, you don't, you know, crank it out like cookies.
But it does seem, even with the World War II and the FDR memorials, that there is a lot of back and forth, there is a lot of consensus, and it is a difficult process.
You bet. You know, that's the nice thing about a tyranny, is the tyrant just says, do this, and everybody says, yes, sir. But in the democracy, where people are used to having their own opinions and feel perfectly free to express them, they're going to do that. I mean, some people thought that it was wrong to show FDR in his wheelchair because in his lifetime, FDR went to a great deal of trouble not to be seen in his wheelchair. And some people felt that was just, you know, they should honor his decision about that. On the other hand, everybody absolutely loves the statue of Fala, his little Scotch terrier.
So when it is all said and done and we look at the Washington Monument, and so where does it rank in obelisk history?
Well, it is certainly the largest obelisk by an order of magnitude. You can argue that it's not a true obelisk in that it is not monolithic. It's not a single stone. But it is certainly, you know, shaped just like Egyptian obelisks. And I'm sure that if we could raise Ramesses the Great from his grave, he's currently in the Cairo Museum, and show him, and I imagine Ramesses the Great would say, I want one of those too.
Well, it's Washington's Monument and the Fascinating History of the Obelisk. The book is published by Bloomsbury. John Steele Gordon, a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the book is Washington's Monument. It is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.